This is the Bris Poinsett Show. This is the Bris Poinsett Show. Oh, the world's most dangerous infomercial. I'm your host, Bris Poinsett. Along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. This is the best of the Bris Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial. I'm your host, Bris Poinsett, and along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. You can also catch clips on youtube.com/Bris Poinsett, plus exclusive bonus content on patreon.com/Bris Poinsett. Make sure to follow us on twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM, that's numbers with a Z, or the Numbers Podcast Network on thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a Z, or wherever you get your podcasts. Help support this channel and get early access to videos plus exclusive content and patrons-only live discussions by becoming a member at patreon.com/BrisPoinsett. David, thank you so much for taking the time today. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. You know, there's a million things to complain about, but nobody wants to hear the complaint. So I'm just going to keep smiling and doing the best I can.
No, I feel that. A well-crafted complaint every now and again, you know, people love it, but
you want to make it, matter. You want it to count for something. And some people, like, you know, complaining about, I don't know, whatever, like the weather or something, is like, especially if it's something you have no control over, it's like, come on now. Although maybe it's better to complain about the things you have no control over than, you know, the things is like, well, if you just did something about it, you could fix this scenario, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I just try to, I had this moment not that long ago, probably about 4 or 5 months ago, where I had a really, really good day. But while I was having a really good day, some really difficult negative things were going on in my life simultaneously. And I started to feel guilty about having that good day. And then I realized, oh, wait a minute, it's possible to have both at the same time, right? And that has sort of shifted my paradigm a little bit, shifted the way I look at things. And so when I start to complain, you know, I try to stop myself and go, okay, wait a sec. Is this a valid complaint or are you just being a punk? You know, so I had a person, a panhandler / houseless / homeless person recently asked me if I could help him out. And I was like, yeah, sorry, I ain't got no cash. And he was like, my life sucks. And da, 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 da. And like to hear him talk made me go, I need to keep my mouth shut because I don't have nearly as much to complain about. So again, there's always something there that there's that song from the 80s. There's always something there to remind me, you know?
Right, right. So, yeah, we're talking, you know, the life of a working artist and the process. And I think something just, you know, being as a fan of your writing, also kind of enjoyed, like, just listening to you talk about some of the little, like, nuances of the process. Mm-hmm. So, for example, like, we'll take comic writing right now.
Yeah.
And like the way you've described doing scripts specifically is like basically like writing letters to the artist.
Yeah.
And could you talk for like people who aren't really like familiar with comic scripts? Can you talk a little bit more about like what that means?
Yeah. So, you know, I write comics and graphic novels and the initial draft that I write of a script, which is that's the draft that's going to be drawn by an artist, right? And at the most, maybe 4 or 5 people will read that script. The editor will read that script. The artist will read that script. The colorist, the person who letters the script. That's about it. Not too many other people, but the person who matters the most to me is the artist, because they're going to be translating a solid probably 60%, if not more, of what I've written from words into a visual representation, right? So the script might say, you know, page one, panel one, Batman sits behind the wheel of the steering wheel of the Batmobile, right? It's two sentences. But an artist has to draw that, you know, and maybe I'll say, you know, Batman has an intense look on his face, or Spider-Man swings, you know, in between two buildings. But what I'm writing, that version of the script that I'm writing, is, again, it's only meant for my creative team to see. And it's meant for them to translate the vast majority of what I've written into a visual representation that will tell the story, that will propel the story forward. And so when I'm writing these scripts, I tend to write them more with my artist in mind, right? More with my editorial team in mind. And knowing that once the art is, it's started to be generated, it's starting to come together, then it's my opportunity to do rewrites, to tweak the dialogue, to change things, to move things around. But in the beginning, you know, and I'll share my scripts with people who want to see them and they want to look at them and study them. But I always tell people, yeah, these for the most part aren't meant to be seen, you know, by the public. And it's the same thing, a similar principle with a screenplay. Like, as if you write a screenplay, that's not what you're not writing that for the audience. You're writing that for the actors. You're writing that for the directors, the cinematographer, whomever. And then they turn it into something else. It's an evolutionary process. It's a progression where it starts out as one thing and it becomes something else. And to me, whenever possible, you want to have the best relationship you can with that artist. You want to communicate your ideas as clearly as possible so that it not only does it give them a set of instructions or directions, but it also sparks their imagination in such a way that you will get something better than what you imagined.
Yeah. I actually used, because I also appreciate, I think a lot of artists are starting to do this where they just, you know, share some of the scripts. Like if you have a collection, like in the back, you'll have some of the scripts just for people to see how it's done. And like, I've actually used your Shaft comic in some of my classes just for like lessons on scene, as far as like using those scripts and like, how do you describe something, one, just for an artist, but also just how do you describe the scene to make sure someone depicts it well, right? Yeah. And just using those examples. And also, sometimes you share just like your own like sketches, mock-ups before that. I'm curious, as far as when you're doing scripts, like how often you also draw for it, even if it's not obviously, like if you're working with another artist, that's not what's going to come in there, but just to I guess like structure the story out.
Well, yeah. So my drawing abilities, the best way to describe them would be remedial at best. But I do have a sense of composition, things like that. So I'll tend to draw these really loose sketches, usually with like stick figures, things like that. Because what I want to do is I want to make sure that a couple things. One is that there's clarity to what I'm saying, but I also want to make sure that it's possible to make it work on a page. In the world of comics, you're limited by the size of the page, by how much information you can fit onto a single page, how many pages there is going to be in an individual issue. And, you know, like when I'm teaching my class at PSU, my writing for comics class, inevitably there'll be a student who will write a scene and it'll be, you know, they'll be like page three and they'll have like 25 panels on that page. And in those 25 panels, each panel has like four or five characters and they have dialogue and there's action. And I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure this can't be done, you know, and then they'll argue with me. I know what I'm doing. I'm like, you know, you actually kind of don't, because it's like physics, right? There's you can't fit. If you have a gallon jug, you can only put a gallon of water in that jug, right? You can't put 5 gallons in a gallon jug. But I like to make sure that when I'm doing something, when I'm writing something that's going to be drawn by somebody else, I want to make sure that I'm not asking somebody to do something that's impossible to do or very difficult to do. And so for me, the best way to do that is to just do a version of it myself. And sometimes, like if I'm, say I'm writing a scene and it takes place, it's taking place in a room and there's two, three, maybe even four characters in the room, I'll draw a diagram of the room itself, right? And then I'll go, okay, this person is sitting over here, this person is sitting over there. And it helps me keep track of the action and where everybody is placed. But then I'll just share it with the artist so they like they can see. So I just did this this script where I sent the artist a diagram of an apartment, and a murder takes place in the apartment. And it's really crucial that, okay, the living room be in this place here, and the kitchen is in this relation to the living room, and here's where the hallway is. And, you know, and I can write that out 20 different times, but I can also just draw it out one time and show and hand him that drawing so he knows. So it's like, okay, whenever you're looking at the character Bobby and he's sitting at the table at the typewriter, that table is in a position where if you're looking at Bobby behind him, you can see the front door to the apartment. And then I say in the script, and it's important that you be able to see the front door of the apartment because someone's going to come through that door five scenes from now, right? And so a lot of it is about if there's a certain amount of heavy lifting or being anal retentive or anything you want to call it, I'm doing that so that my artist is always going to have a difficult job because drawing the comics is really hard. So my job is to make it everything that they have that I'm asking of them as clear and concise as possible.
Right. And I guess just like right now, as far as because you write for a lot of people, yourself included. What the current breakdown is in terms of just, and I guess this would just be on comics projects, never mind different buckets of income, such you mentioned teaching earlier. But yeah, like what is like right now in terms of projects, where is everything spread out?
So I have three really big books coming out, two in 2024 and one in 2025. The two that are coming out in 2024, one of the books is 100% done. It's completely done. It comes out in July of 2024. I'm assuming it's being printed somewhere like in China or Indonesia or somewhere like that. And that's a prose novel. That's straight prose, no pictures. And then I've got a graphic novel that's coming out late next year, probably October, November. The final date hasn't been set yet. The artist is still drawing it. He's about 80 pages away from finishing. It's a 280-page book. So that's coming along. And then I have another nonfiction book coming out 2025. Those are three big things, right? And they're on the calendar in some capacity. I know they're coming. And the third book is a nonfiction history of the Black image in motion pictures. And it doesn't have a title yet. Still working on it. A bunch of things have been changed. The date keeps getting pushed back. It was supposed to be published this year. A bunch of delays caused that to be pushed back to next year. Then more delays pushed back to 2025. So those are the three big things. And then I've got, like, there's a book that we're negotiating, myself, my lawyer, my agent, we're negotiating the final contract. And that's it's an original graphic novel, but it's also work for hire, meaning the idea existed and someone came to me and said, you know, this is the idea we have. We're, you know, we really want to turn this into a graphic novel. We don't know how to do it. Can you help us? And so I'm doing that one. And then everything else is like smaller projects that I don't even have publishers for. I've already hired artists. They've already gotten started. And I've already made the commitment that either I'll publish it myself or I'll find a publisher later. I'm in LA right now visiting family. Next weekend, there's a convention. And so I'm going and the artists that I'm working with on all these indie projects, they're all going to be there. So I'm just going to go sit down and talk to them and be like, okay, how are things coming along? Where are we at? let's get things moving. So I have these three different projects that I'm hoping I will be able to get all three of them out next year, but we'll see. Nothing ever goes the way we want it to. It never works out quite that way. And so again, I don't know if that's really answering your question. I'm kind of in this weird zone because I'm rediscovering how much I like writing prose, and that's a very, to me, that's a very daunting process because I can simply write Batman punches the Joker, right? And then somebody draws that and they make it look super dope. Whereas, you know, if it's a prose thing, I Batman delivered a right cross with all of his strength. He felt to connect with the Joker's jaw with a resounding crack. You know what I'm saying? Like I actually have to paint pictures with words. And I love doing that, but it's a muscle that isn't as well developed as it used to be. And when I drove from Portland, Oregon down to Los Angeles, California last week, spent some time with my family, and I was listening to audiobooks the whole way down. And I was like, oh, there's nothing like a well-crafted sentence. There's nothing like a well-written scene. And I was like, I want to do more of this. And so I keep thinking about that, you know, like I think that's where there's some stuff that's going to be on the horizon that I think is because, and part of the reason I want to do it is because it's a challenge. It's a bigger challenge to me.
I have to imagine that maybe like part of that with not being so much on prose for a while, like, is that just a matter of busyness? You know, we talked about the different projects.
Yeah.
Never mind teaching, you know, Comic-Con appearances, you know,
it's definitely that, but it's also just a different style of writing, you know, like in writing a comic script, unless you're like Alan Moore. For those people that don't know who Alan Moore is, Alan Moore wrote Watchmen, amongst other things, V for Vendetta, a bazillion different things, but he's a wordy dude, right? Like, but a lot of times your comic scripts they're as minimal as possible. In some cases, I just did a project for Marvel where my artist was a cat out of Brazil. So, you know, his native language is Portuguese. English is his second language. Everything that's being sent to him is being translated. So there's no point in writing a big flowery script with tons of descriptors. It's like you want it to be as literal as possible. You know, I've worked with other artists where English isn't their first language, and they've struggled at times because, like, whoever translates the scripts for them doesn't necessarily like things like metaphor doesn't necessarily go over well sometimes. You know, and the last thing you want to do is you know, write something in a script that your artist takes literally and then draws it in the script, right? So, but prose to me is for me, it takes a level of confidence that is difficult for me to find sometimes, because it's the confidence in me and the words that I am choosing. And there's nobody else. There's nobody drawing it. There's nobody coloring that drawing. There's no one adding lettering. I'm having to paint that picture, and I'm painting that picture with words. And then I'm asking you, the reader, to not only read those words, but to envision what it is that I'm talking about. You know, I spent the summer, I reread all of Walter Mosley's Easy Rollins books over the summer. I'd only read about half of them, and I decided to get caught up. But I started from the beginning with Devil in a Blue Dress. And now I'm reading, he has another detective novel series I'm reading. And Walter Mosley is just one of my favorite writers of all time, right? So I'm reading some of his stuff. And then I'm reading some James Baldwin. And James Baldwin is my favorite writer of all time. And I'll just read stuff and I'm like, man, where did this come from? How did this idea, how were you able to translate this into words? And how are you able to paint this picture? And that's such a challenge. And it terrifies me. But that's all the more reason to do it, right? If you're afraid of it, you know, it's when I teach at PSU, I'll have some, you know, a couple students take my class and they're like, oh, I thought this was going to be an easy grade. It's like, then why would you take it? Like, why take a course that you think is going to be an easy grade? Why take a course that you think isn't going to challenge you? And I won't go so far as to say make you a better person, but that will help you grow and evolve into more than who you are. So that's why I, you know, that's how I feel about prose, man. Prose, it's a challenge, man, but it's a good challenge. And we should, you know, at least for myself, I feel like I need to rise to it.
Yeah. I'm generally curious as far as, again, just having your hand in so many different pots, like where, one, how you balance out and kind of like, I guess, find the discipline to have like all the writing time it would take, especially when it comes to stuff, you know, like you said, like that you are financing or mm-hmm. that you are actively looking for publishers for, but you know, you've already put all these other pieces in place. Cause I know I've definitely my own self just like recently been thinking like, wow, how much writing am I doing for myself right now? How even reading, like trying to get better, but and I've listened to you talking about just like kind of like that information, or not information, but like inspiration cycle. It's like read Mosley, I read Baldwin, get that charge and write. But I just think about, again, like if you're on the road all the time at cons, if you're teaching, if you've got however many assignments from the different publishers, like how do you balance that out?
Oh, terribly. I don't balance it out well at all, you know. So especially the last few years, I've grown, I've gotten really bad at hitting my deadlines, and part of it is work overload, but then it was also a lot of family health issues got in the way. And so the key thing is like, if I can't hit a deadline, I let my editor know in advance I'm not going to hit the deadline. So I've got a deadline this coming Monday that I'm probably not going to hit. And so now, unfortunately, it's already too late to let my editor know this because it's Thanksgiving weekend. She's out of the office already. So on Monday, first thing Monday, I'm going to have to send her an email and be like, okay, here's what I have so far. You'll get the rest towards the end of the week, something like that. A lot of it's, I'm trying to get better at it because I do feel like I lost my way. And, you know, let's say I have three projects going somewhat simultaneously, and I'll look at them and go, okay, so which one is due right away or due next week? And, you know, I'll usually set the schedule and be like, okay, today's Tuesday. So Tuesday, I'm going to work on this script for Marvel, or, you know, and I'm not going to stop working on it until it's done. But if I sit down and nothing's coming to me, and I still have a few days left to work on that script, I might open up another project. And just like, sometimes you just got to go with what moves you. Sometimes you got to go with where the deadlines are. Like, that should always be first and foremost. But if you've got some wiggle room and you know yourself well enough to know that, like, okay, you know, this typical script for Marvel's is 20 pages. Typical story is 20 issue. 20. Back that up. A typical issue is 20 pages of story, right? So you have to write a script for a 20-page story. And I know that, you know, ideally I'd like to have at least 5 to 6 days to work on a script, right? And by that, I mean to get the first draft done and then get 2 or 3 revision drafts done. So anywhere from like we'll say 5 to 10 days. But I also know from experience that if I absolutely have to, I can write it in like 3 days, 2 or 3 days. But that's really pushing it. That's burning the candle at both ends. That's drinking more coffee than a man my age should be drinking, not getting enough sleep. So I've tried to stop doing that. But for better or worse, I'm a crunch writer, man. And a lot of that comes from years of working at a newspaper and, always being under a tight deadline. And it's like, oh, you got 12 hours to turn this story around. Okay, then you do it, right? Like I recognize the fact that I'm good at that, but I don't need to be good at that anymore. But that habit is still there.
That's funny. As far as just yeah, again, we're taught not to procrastinate in school and all
Oh.
that. And then I know I'm same person. Like I'm a little maybe I'm a little bit better than I used to be, but not really.
Yeah, no, I'm when I was a kid, your teachers would the teachers would always say, and don't wait till the last minute to do this assignment. And I always waited to the last minute. And I was convinced that I remember being in like second, third grade, being convinced that the teacher had like a machine that they could put the paper into and it would tell you how recently the pencil had been, how, like this is something only a child could think of, right? And once I figured out that that didn't exist, all bets were off, man. I would be doing homework at 7 in the morning the day it was due, and for better or worse, most people never notice the difference. I remember, because I worked at Willamette Week, the newspaper Willamette Week, for years, and I managed to keep it a secret from the entire staff and all the editors how quickly I could write something. And that paper always came out on Wednesdays. And so Tuesdays was always a crunch. My section was always the last to go to print. And so it was the last to go out the door. And something had happened, and like at the last minute, like I had to cut 2 pages out of my section or something like that. Something, and long story short, was something needed to be written, and it had to be about 250 words, and there was less than an hour to write this whole little news blurb. And there's all this frantic, everyone's running around, it's got to be done, it's got to be done. And I was like, yeah, okay, hold on, I'll be back. I sat down at my desk. I typed up this 250 word little news blurb. I handed it off to the copy editors, and they and I remember the copy editor looked at me and went, "You can do it that fast?" And I was like, "Shh, don't tell anybody." Like I just like that was my secret. And I remember Ian, the copy editor, reading it, and he was like, "This is as good as everything you write." And I was like, yeah, I know. I like let's not talk about this. I don't want people knowing. So yeah, that's it. But I need to get better at finding that balance. It's I'm not getting any younger, and it becomes harder to maintain it. Conversely, I get behind schedule, and then it's like I've kind of lost my mind, just trying to get back on track.
I like that you brought up the copy editor Willamette Week because I think that's another thing, especially when I talk with like younger writers and students right now, as far as actually and teachers who are reaching out to me to do this, where it's like the emphasis, the recurring theme is always get them to take editing seriously all the time. But can you just talk about like the importance of either working with a good editor or just being a good editor, and like how much, I forget the saying, but it's like there's no such thing as good writing, there's only good editing, so something along those
Yeah,
lines.
no, I, oh man, when I was brought on staff at Willamette Week, I'd never even worked on a Macintosh before, on an Apple computer before. I didn't even know how those things work. I'm a PC guy, all the way. I didn't know any. I knew so little, and but I recognized from day one that everything goes through the copy editors, right? So get to know them. and get to know their process. And so I got to know them. I worked with the other editors. And there's two types of editors, right? There's the type that I feel who are like, their job is to make sure you get your stuff turned in on time and that it makes sense. And then there's the editors who feel like they got to get their fingerprints all over everything, right? I prefer the ones who just make sure everything is on time and that I don't sound like an idiot. And I'm always open to suggestions or questions, but there's inevitably, sometimes I'll have to say to somebody, an editor, I'll be like, yeah, maybe you just want to write this yourself, right? Like, I'm very fortunate that I'm at a point in my career, in my life, in my career, where even if I pitch an idea to somebody, they know who it is that's pitching it. They know that it's David Walker. Now, if they come to me, if an editor from a publisher comes to me, they know who they're coming to, right? And so once in a while, I'll have to say, like, you came to me for a reason, right? And these notes that you're giving me all negate the reason you came to me, you know? And you see that a lot in work for hire stuff, especially in comics. If you're working for a publisher like Marvel or DC, inevitably, yeah, they come to you for a reason, but they, like, Batman is Batman. People are going to buy Batman no matter who wrote it. People are going to buy Spider-Man no matter who wrote it. And you may think you've got the greatest ideas in the world for Thor or Green Lantern. And, like, at the end of the day, they don't care that much. They care about hitting the deadlines and getting it out there and staying on brand. And the further you go from the brand, you know, the less likely they are to let you do what you let you be the genius that you think you are. Now, if you truly are a genius, there's a handful of creators over the decades who've proven their geniuses working. You know, when Frank Miller did Daredevil, he proved he was a genius with Daredevil, right? When Walt Simonson did Thor, he proved he was a genius with Thor. Most of us don't ever get that opportunity in mainstream comics. And so if you are a genius, or if you suspect you're a genius, don't try to prove it through somebody else's property that now is controlled by billion-dollar corporations. You know, I remind people all the time, Marvel is owned by Disney. DC is owned by, you know, Warner Brothers Discovery. And they care about one thing and one thing only, and that's making money. They don't care how creative you are or how dope your ideas are or how great your art is. They want to make money. And they will produce stuff. They will publish stuff that is not of the best quality because they're convinced people are going to buy it otherwise. They would rather not take a chance and make a little less money than to be too radical and then potentially lose money.
Kind of to that point, Kirsten, does it make it, you know, having seen so much success both with, you know, established properties, but then, you know, having projects like Bitterroot kind of just blow up like this, like, does that make those moments that much more rewarding?
It can. I mean, it's, you know, Bitterroot is definitely, it's been successful and it's been rewarding, but it's also, you know, Bitterroot is three guys. It's myself, it's Chuck Brown, and it's Sanford Green. And we own it. We are the bosses, but we also are three incredibly different people with different sets of priorities, right? And in a lot of ways, it's like you look at NWA right before Ice Cube left, right? And it was like, well, there's a reason why Ice Cube left, right? There's a band back in the 80s called The Police. And, you know, they were this sort of new wave rock band out of England. Younger people might not know them, but in the 80s, The Police was one of the biggest bands of that time, right? And man, those guys didn't get along at all. They made great music, but they didn't get along. And I'm not saying that Chuck, Sanford, and I are like that, like NWA or The Police or Fleetwood Mac or the Eagles or any of those bands that notoriously didn't get along. But it's like, you know, Chuck still wants to write stuff for Marvel and DC. And I don't care if I ever write stuff for Marvel and DC again. I mean, if the opportunity presents itself, great. But it's like, that's not what I'm working towards. And Sanford is doing his things. And so, like, there's times where I feel like Bitterroot is not the number one priority there will be times where it's my number one priority and Sanford's number one priority, but it's not Chuck's. Or there'll be times when it's Chuck's priority, but it's not mine or it's not Sanford's. And it's very rare that all three of us are on the same wavelength at the same time. And we have been and we will be again. But right now, like, I was just talking to someone the other day. I was like, I think Chuck is writing like a Teen Titans book for DC, but I don't know because I haven't talked to him in months, right? Like, he just, whatever's going on in his life, he doesn't want to include me in on it. And it's like, and I'm going through my stuff, so I'm not going to like beg him to give me updates with what's going on. But it's everybody wants to be the boss, right? Everybody wants to be the boss until they are the boss, right? Like, because when you're the boss, now you got to make sure everyone gets their paycheck on time, and you might have to discipline somebody, you might have to fire somebody. And it's like, and suddenly it's like, oh, well, wait a second, I'll just go back to being work for hire, I'll just go back to being middle management. But for me, there's no greater feeling than when I'm in control, when I'm making the creative decisions, when I'm working with an artist or another writer and we're really clicking. And you know, maybe we're arguing a little bit back and forth, but we're also like, we have one goal in mind, and that's to write the best book we can possibly do, put out the best piece of entertainment we can possibly put out. And once you get there, man, that feels good.
Yeah, yeah. Have some more my own life, just management jobs right now. So that's very, that talk about being the boss is very relatable. You know, curious, because again, like, let's stick with on comics here. You know, again, as you've noted, like, writing is one part of the job.
Yeah.
But curious, like, how much, maybe it's like a ballpark percentage, like, how much does the appearances, like cons or otherwise, make up of that? And like, what, you know, like, what is that, what does that obligation look like?
It's different for different people, and you know, artists make more money, I think, as a rule, than a writer will at a convention, because an artist doesn't even have to bring any books with them. They can bring prints and stickers and, you know, t-shirts, posters, things like that, that are cost less to produce and are easier to carry, don't cost as much to ship, right? Whereas I got to bring books with me everywhere. And, you know, the wear and tear of going to conventions was starting to get to me. And I had, in 2019, I had set a goal, which was that I was going to cut back on the amount of conventions I did in 2020. My graphic novel on the history of the Black Panther Party was going to come out in 2021. And I was going to use 2021 to be my quote unquote retirement tour. I was going to do a handful of conventions. And then by 2022, I was only going to do maybe two conventions a year, because I was doing anywhere from 10 to 15 conventions a year, you know? So it was always, there's seldom, very, very rarely before were there conventions in November or December. But from January to October, those 10 months, there's always a convention almost anywhere in the country or the world. There's almost a comic convention every week. So you could be going. I had a friend one year who did 52 shows in a year. He did one show every weekend. I didn't want to do that anymore. But then COVID hit. And so COVID robbed me of the 2020 convention experience and the 2021 convention experience, but also it robbed me of that plan I had, which was to get out of going to conventions as much, right? And, you know, part of the reasons one of the reasons I didn't want to do as many conventions was because my mom's health was failing, and I wanted to be more readily available for her. But, you know, in 2018, 2019, I was in a relationship and I didn't like being away from her or the kids. And so I was like, okay. But then, you know, again, the pandemic hit and suddenly I couldn't do that thing. And not only could I not do it, I wasn't getting that revenue stream that was coming from it. And then the breakup happened and suddenly there wasn't anybody to be around for as much. I wasn't getting to see the kids. My mom's health got worse and I realized, you know, I need to put her in a home. All these things have changed. And so now I'm like, I don't want to be as dependent on the conventions from a financial standpoint, because that can be foolish. But I do like going to the conventions. I do like going to other cities. I do like being on panels. I do like meeting people. And we're getting to a point, I think we're within the comic industry, I'm starting to think that like that might be more important, especially if you're indie, because it's getting harder to sell your books through the stores. So it's almost like being a band who goes on tour. The bands that tour and they make most of their money through their merch and their concerts. It's sort of the similar thing. Like, you know, I've got some books out there that I've self-published, and the only way you can get those is either get them from me online. And something happened. My website's been down for over a month. I can't get it fixed. So there's that, right? Or you got to come see me at a convention. You know, you got to know how to find me. And it's almost like those cats that sell the mixtapes out of the back of their car, out of the trunk of their car.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious as far as like the connection between when like properties that you write, whether they are established, whether they're, I know I haven't followed the latest updates, but I know they're working on like bringing Bitterroot to like the screen. Yeah. Like the connection between, so like when these especially like Marvel DC properties, because like we're like, oh my God, there's a Cyborg movie, or
yeah,
I think you posted about Naomi, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but kind of like finding out like everyone else when the show got canceled. But
yeah, I found out after everyone else. Yeah.
Yeah. But is there like a connection at all to that, as far as that comes back to like the writers and the artists on the comics, or is it just like, you know, you're sitting one day and you hear, oh, they're going to adapt this for a thing. That's cool.
Well, with Bitterroot, there's a little bit more. I'm kept in the loop a little bit more. I my opinion gets asked every now and then. With Naomi, which was a show that they did on the CW, there was nothing. There was no contact, no communication whatsoever. I found out stuff via Twitter or Instagram, whatever. Oh, well, life goes on. And with Bitterroot, it's that's shaping up to be a really big project and a really big production. And it's a sort of project and sort of production with people who I just know to get out of their way. And if Regina King has a question, or Ryan Coogler has a question, Ryan Coogler is the producer, Regina King's the director. If they have questions, they know how to find me. But like, I don't want to be one of those people who ruins the chances of the production moving forward because I ask too many questions or I make too many demands. And part of that is because I co-own this property with two other people. And it's like, so that's three people. That's three opportunities for things to go wrong, right? And whereas some of the other stuff that I have, it's like, no, this is just me. And there's a couple of projects that are amongst the ones that haven't come out yet, that won't be out till next year in 2025, that, you know, we're talking to people in Hollywood, myself, my business partner, my lawyer, my management. And those are ones where it's like, yeah, you know, if you want this thing, that's great. But you're going to have to do two things. One is you're going to have to pay me. You're going to have to come up with the money. And you're going to have to know that I want to be involved in this, right? Like I want an opportunity to write the screenplay. Or if this is going to be a TV show, I want to write episodes of the TV show. And, you know, and that's the thing. It's so much of these modes of operation, these business models, there's so many of them are meant to exclude the writer from that process, right? It's to get you to generate the best idea you can possibly generate, do it the best you can, and then they're going to take it from you and they're going to make a lot of money off of it, excuse me, but they don't necessarily want to hear from you. This is what the Writers Guild strike was, part of what the Writers Guild strike was all about. And it's like, and with some projects, like, yeah, okay, I don't want to be involved in that. But there's other ones where it's like, nope, you don't get this one unless I get to work on it, unless I have some input. You know, it's really easy to watch a basketball game or to watch a football game and go, oh man, I would have run this play this way. I would have done this. And it's like, yeah, you would have done this. When was the last time you were actually on the floor? When was the last time you were out on the field? Man, you ain't got nothing you can do. And film and television tend to be that way too, where there's like a lot of writers out there who are working in film and television who will take a property that you've written that's won awards and that's successful and go, oh, I can do this better. And we've seen it. We've seen it where, you know, Batman and Robin, the one with George Clooney, which was a terrible movie, was a lot of people thinking they could do it better, right? You know, you see some of these movies, we've all seen movies that are adapt books or graphic novels, whatever, and they're terrible. And it's like, yeah, this is what happens. Like, you can't improve on Spider-Man. Like, Spider-Man is one of the greatest superheroes of all time. And like, you try to change it too much, and it's going to be garbage.
It's funny you mentioned that Batman and Robin. A friend and I just recently rewatched that for, you know, the is this really as bad as we remember it from whenever? And it's like, wow, yeah, this is incredible. This is wow. But you know, it's interesting with a lot of artists that interviews I do, especially some of them have been around music, and there's this dynamic where it's like, okay, I'm a musician in Portland, the industry isn't here. Whereas in like comics, there's actually like a real mm-hmm. foothold. Can you just talk about like what that means, especially as like a creator, like how that, as opposed to like if you were writing out of Iowa or somewhere, like,
yeah,
what does that do?
Well, I think, you know, it's cool because, you know, if you live in Portland, you can go to any one of the local comic shops. You're likely to run into somebody who works in the industry and you can pick their brain, and there are little events and little social gatherings that go on. And so there's a sense of community that is you might not get if you say you lived in Idaho or Iowa or Indiana or, you know, somewhere like that. But at the same time, you can create your art anywhere, right? You can live anywhere, create your art, and the internet has made it possible that you can share it from anywhere. And I had somebody recently ask me about, you know, should she move to Portland? She's a cartoonist and looking to like make a name for herself. And I was like, yeah, you could move to Portland, but that's not a guarantee that you're going to get the career you're looking for. It means you will have an opportunity to meet some people and maybe hang out with them, maybe even collaborate with them. But you can create from anywhere, right? And that's what you should be doing. And then as things grow and develop for you, then maybe you might want to move. I mean, I love the comics community in Portland. I did an event and I saw three or four other professionals. I don't get to see that often. It was great getting caught up with them. But, you know, Portland as a city has become difficult to live in for a whole host of reasons. Like, and so the best part, the fact that there's a thriving comics community there is not, for me, the main reason to stick around, right? And if an opportunity came up someplace else, I would maybe, you know, I would consider leaving at this point.
Kind of a similar note. Do you feel like, again, you write in a variety of different mediums, but like, do you feel like a Portland influence kind of just like, or I guess I could say like, how does just being a lifelong Portlander like show up in your writing and your work?
Good question. Well, you know, I actually moved to Portland when I was in middle school. So I was about 12 or 13 when I moved here. And this city really, Portland shaped who I am in a lot of ways. Because I, you know, I went from living in a small town on the East Coast. You know, granted, that small town was a 45-minute train ride from New York City, but I wasn't going into New York City on my own that much. It wasn't until later I would go back east, see my grandparents in the summers, take the train into New York. But when I moved to Portland in middle school, like I hit the ground running, right? And, you know, got a bus, my mom got me a bus pass. And I was like, I was going all over town and I was going to the movies and I was going to the bookstores and comic book stores and just doing things and exploring. And I came into my own. It just happened to be at that point in my life when I was really discovering things that I loved, and there was a lot of resources for me to explore. And so I can't separate who I am now from the influence that Portland had on me, right? There was, even then in the 80s, there was enough of a comic scene that there were other artists and other creators that, you know, they would do a, like a convention, this little, like, almost like a swap meet, like once or twice a year, but everybody would be there and you know, oh, here, you know, I got my little sketchbook. This is what I drew. And, you know, you're showing it to each other and you're comparing notes. And in that regard, this, you know, this was a good city. This was a good, has been a good city to me, and it continues to be good, but there's other challenges. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know, for me, I'm also older at this point. I'm the old dude in the room, right? People call me their comic book dad. Someone called me their comic book grandfather. I almost punched him in the face. But I'm, you know, I'm with some of the creators I'm working with are 20, 30 years younger than me. And so it's like, you know, I'm not saying that it's time for me to get out of the game or step aside, but it's also time, like, yo, it's your time to shine. It's, you know, can I help you with something? Can I give you some advice? Can I, oh, maybe we can even collaborate on something. But it's like, you know, I've done it. I've been to the mountaintop, and now I'm looking around and I'm looking to see, okay, what's the next mountain I'm going to climb? And that's the thing, at this point in my life and my career, I've climbed multiple mountains, you know, and it's like, and that's the thing. Once you get to the top of a mountain, you look around and you damn well better be going, okay, so what's next? Like, you know, no one just wants to chill at the top of a mountain. That's pointless, right? It's cold up there.
Oh, that might be a, might clip that one out for this. First off, thank you again for taking the time today and all the insights. One thing I like to kind of ask for every interview is just, you know, and it could be in comics, it could be in prose, it could be film, it could be something entirely different, but curious if there's anything in particular in the world of the arts that's just exciting you right now, that's something you're not working on.
Oh, that's something that I'm not working on.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I recently watched the third season of Reservation Dogs, and that show, and several other shows too. Atlanta was another show that did this for me. Reservation Dogs did it. I haven't seen the Bayard Rustin movie yet, but I'm expecting that this will do it for me. Is like, I get excited when I see things that, like, one of two things, like, I wish I had done it, or I'm like, I'm just so thankful somebody did it, right? That's how I felt with Reservation Dogs. When I watched Atlanta, I was like, every episode, I was like, damn, I wish I'd done this. I was like, and I get excited when I see people taking chances and doing things in ways that I've never quite seen before. And so I feed off of that, and I haven't been I haven't been watching as much stuff as I normally do just because I've been trying to get my own stuff going. But like I recently started listening to some audiobooks just because it's not quite the same as reading, but it's also it can be engaging. And so I'm almost done listening to I've read all of Walter Mosley's E.Z. Rollins books. I've said that before, but now I'm going through some of his other series, and I'm going through the Joe King Oliver books that Walter Mosley wrote, and like listening to them. And it's like there's something about the way he writes a sentence and the way he structures a paragraph. And it's like when you talk about the power of what a word, a series of words can do strung together, and how they can take you to a place and introduce you to a person and show you something. Oh man. So it's Down by the River Unto the Sea, I believe is the title of the book that I'm listening to right now. And it's just blowing my mind. And it's reminding me of how much I love prose, you know? And so that's it. I'm always looking for something, and I'm gonna be hard pressed to find anything that's impressed me the way Reservation Dogs did. Because that third season of Reservation Dogs was like, holy crap, I can't believe, you know. All three seasons were great. Some of the funniest television I've ever watched. But season three, every episode, I laughed and I cried. Laughed out loud and cried like an ugly cried while I was watching it. And that's something, man. Like to be able to feel something, because usually I sit there and I'll watch TV with just sort of a blank look on my face. Like, what am I watching? And that's the sort of stuff that moves me. And then in terms of comics, you know, there's the last thing that I read that blew me away. It's called Days of Sand, and it's by a French writer, artist. I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but it was all about the American Dust Bowl. It was all about the Midwest during the 1930s, and it was like one of the most incredible graphic novels I've ever read. And I was just like, I love to read things that and see things that either I wish I'd done, or I'm like, I never would have thought to do this, you know. And that should be the thing. It's one of the reasons why I don't watch, you know, I'm not as, I don't have any desire to go see Aquaman. You know, I just don't, because that's not where my heart and soul is right now.
Oh, that's funny, because yeah, I've I tend to go to like all, well, most of the things. I didn't do the Flash for Ezra Miller reasons, but yeah, no, I feel like that's kind of how I mean, one, just yeah, second that on Reservation Dogs in Atlanta. I was still a friend and I were doing some this little community screening events around a couple of episodes of, I think, season three, but like that, those last two seasons, they ended up in events like that. I think I pulled a, why is the acronym escaping me right now? But it was about like, what was it, Young White Avatar? That's what it was, the YWA episode. I was like, I was using that for one of my classes on, I forget what the lesson was for, but I was just like, I gotta put this in somehow. But yeah, no, I feel that. Yeah, David, thank you so much again for taking the time this afternoon.
Most definitely, man. Thanks for having me. This was good. We'll have to get caught up and go have coffee at some point in real life, face to face at some point soon.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, yeah, thank you again, and yeah, enjoy the rest of your day.
All right, man. I'll talk to you soon.
This has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Again, you can catch us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7, or you can catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. If you want access to exclusive bonus coverage, you can go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. And make sure to follow us on Twitch at twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM, that's numbers with a Z, or on the Numbers Podcast Network on all podcasting platforms, or the numberspodcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a C.